Imagine you were just walking through the streets of Athens.
Oh, yeah, right in the middle of the Golden Age.
Exactly. The Parthenon is going up. Democracy is this brand new experiment, and the energy is just electric.
It was the place to be.
And for generations, the smartest people in the Greek world, the ones we call the pre-Socratics, they have been entirely obsessed with one big thing.
Cracking the code of the universe.
Right. They wanted the absolute truth with a capital T.
They really thought if they just looked hard enough, they could find the underlying stuff that makes reality work.
It was a massive intellectual project.
They weren't just doing physics either. I mean, they were looking for a unified theory of everything.
A theory that connects it all.
Yeah, they believed that the same rational order, the logic that governed the stars, also governed the city-state, and even the human soul.
So they were hunting for what you would call a metaphysical grounding.
Exactly. A bedrock reality that would basically tell us how we are supposed to live.
But then, seemingly overnight, the whole vibe
The
shifts.
total 180.
A new crew rolls into town, and they look at all this high-minded searching for truth, and they essentially say, "You know what? You guys are wasting your time.
Nobody knows what the universe is made of, so just give it up.
Stop worrying about being right and start worrying about winning."
It was incredibly dramatic. We are shifting from those pre-Socratics who wanted to know the absolute truth to the sophists.
The sophists.
Right, a group of thinkers who realize that, well, maybe the truth doesn't actually matter as much as persuasion does.
And that is exactly what we are going to take a deep dive into today. We are looking at who these guys were and how they effectively invented skepticism, relativism, and the dark art of rhetoric.
And we are basing this whole deep dive on a really brilliant history of philosophy lecture by Dr. Arthur Holmes.
It is a fantastic foundation for this. But before we get to the sophists and their specific arguments, I really want to understand the failure of the guys who came before them.
The pre-Socratics.
Yeah. You mentioned they were looking for a unified theory. Why did that whole project fall apart?
Well, simply put, they just couldn't agree on anything.
Not a single thing.
I mean, you had Thales saying everything is made of water.
Right.
Then Heraclitus comes along saying, no, it is fire and constant change. You can't step in the same river twice.
And then Parmenides says change is literally an illusion and everything is completely static.
Exactly. It was just this chaotic marketplace of conflicting ideas. And after 100 years of this,
People got tired.
major fatigue. The intellectual whiplash was real.
So the sophists walk into this mess. They see all these renowned geniuses contradicting each other, and they just throw their hands up.
They did. They looked at the entire track record of philosophy and decided it was a totally failed project.
Just a giant waste of time.
And they had two very specific intellectual weapons concepts, really, that they used to justify blowing the whole thing up.
Okay, laying them on me. What were the two weapons?
The first one is a concept called equipollence.
Equipollence. That sounds like a geometry term.
It does, yeah.
Yeah.
But it is actually about weight. It is this idea that for literally every argument you make for a specific position,
I can make one against it.
right, you can construct a counterargument that has the exact same weight.
So it is just a stalemate.
A permanent stalemate. Imagine a set of vintage scales. You put your absolute best argument for, say, justice is good on one side.
Okay, my strongest point.
And I put my best argument for justice is for suckers on the other side. If the sophists are right, those scales balance perfectly every single time.
Wow. And if the arguments cancel each other out,
Then you can never actually prove anything is objectively true.
that is incredibly frustrating. It feels a bit like gaslighting reality.
Oh, it gets worse. The second weapon is incommensurability.
Okay, that one is a mouthful. Incommensurability, what does that actually mean in plain English?
It basically means having no common measure. It is the idea that different philosophical views, or even different cultural beliefs, are so fundamentally distinct that they cannot even be translated into one another.
They just don't jive.
They don't jive at all. Think about trying to measure the distance from New York to London using liters.
You can't. It is the wrong tool entirely.
Precisely. The frameworks simply do not match. The sophists argued that because every single person has a different background.
Different culture, different life experiences.
Right. Because of all that, my view of the world and your view of the world are incommensurable. We are not even having the same conversation.
So let me make sure I have this straight. If equipollence means all arguments are essentially tied,
Yes.
and incommensurability means we can't even understand each other's foundational viewpoints,
Yeah.
then the search for objective truth is just dead.
Dead on arrival. And that realization creates a massive vacuum in Greek society. Because if you can't know the truth about nature or the gods, what is actually left to do with your life?
I guess you just focus on, I don't know, getting by.
You focus on practical success.
You
focus entirely on the here and now.
Survival and thriving.
Exactly. The sophists pivoted away from being these high-minded scientists and philosophers to being teachers of rhetoric.
The art of persuasion.
Yes, and they started charging money, lots of money, to teach young Athenian aristocrats how to navigate this truthless world.
Which brings us to the first really big name in this movement, Protagoras.
Oh, Protagoras.
He is the guy who famously said, man is the measure of all things.
Of things that are that they are, of things that are not that they are not.
No, I have heard that quote 1,000 times in pop culture, and usually in a very positive, empowering way, like humans are the center of the universe.
Right, the humanist interpretation.
But in this context, the context of the sophists, it sounds very different.
It is the absolute grandfather of relativism. Protagoras is saying that reality isn't something out there waiting to be discovered by science.
Reality is what you make it.
Reality is what you perceive it to be. If the wind feels cold to you, it is cold for you.
And if it feels warm to me, it is warm for me.
Exactly. There is no actual objective temperature of the wind that we can appeal to.
So my truth is my truth, and your truth is your truth.
That is it entirely. And he applied this logic to everything, even the gods.
Really? In ancient Athens, that seems risky.
It was. Protagoras was famously agnostic. He basically said, look, between the subject of the gods being so incredibly obscure and human life being so terribly short.
I just don't have time for it.
Exactly. I don't have time to figure out if Zeus actually exists.
Which honestly sounds pretty reasonable for a busy guy trying to make a living in a bustling city. But there is a much darker side to Protagoras, right?
Oh, okay.
There was this massive accusation thrown at him later by Socrates and Plato that he taught people how to make the weaker cause the stronger.
This was the major scandal of his career.
But wait, isn't that just being a lawyer? I mean, if I hire a defense attorney today, I absolutely want them to make my case stronger, even if I am guilty. Why was this so controversial back then?
Because the Greeks fundamentally believed in a natural order to the universe. They believed that the stronger cause was inherently the one that was true and just.
The truth naturally rises to the top.
By definition, the truth should win. So when Protagoras teaches you how to make the weaker cause the lie, or the injustice beat the truth in a debate, he is not just teaching you basic debate skills.
He is messing with the fabric of reality.
He is totally inverting it. He is teaching you how to hack the system so that the wrong side actually wins.
It is like using cheat codes in a video game. You aren't actually better at the game, you just broke the rules of the code.
That is a perfect way to put it. And if you think Protagoras was shaking things up with his relativism, just wait until we get to Gorgias.
Gorgias, the nihilist.
Well, you absolute nihilist.
Yeah.
If Protagoras opened the door to skepticism, Gorgias kicked it completely off the hinges and set the house on fire.
I love that. So what was his deal?
We have this summary of his core philosophy preserved by an ancient historian, and it is a three-step argument that is honestly deeply terrifying if you sit and think about it for too long.
Okay, let's walk through it. What is step one?
Step one, nothing exists.
Okay, bold opener, just right out of the gate, nothing is real. Step two.
Step two, if anything did exist, we could not know it. It would be entirely incomprehensible to the human mind.
And step three?
Step three. Even if we could somehow comprehend it, we could never communicate it to anyone else.
I want to stop and focus on that third one. We couldn't communicate it because we are talking right now, and I feel like we are communicating pretty well. Why does Gorgias think that is literally impossible?
This is probably his most profound point. He argues that there is a hard, fundamental barrier between speech and reality.
What kind of barrier?
Well, speech is made of words, sounds. Reality is made of physical objects. Perceptibles, things you can touch and see.
Okay, I'm following.
Think about it this way. If I describe a color to you, let's say I describe the color red. Is the word red the exact same thing as the actual visual experience of seeing the color red?
No, obviously not. The word is just a sound I make with my vocal cords. The color is a photon hitting my eye.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Gorgias says that just as you cannot hear a color, you cannot transfer the actual reality of an object through speech.
You are just throwing verbal symbols at someone.
Right. You can never truly transfer your raw thought into my mind.
Yeah.
We are permanently trapped in our own heads.
That is incredibly isolating. Mm-hmm. It really is. So if I cannot actually share the truth with you because words are just barrier noises, then what is the point of even talking?
Power.
Power.
Pure power. Gorgias concludes that if speech cannot magically convey truth, its only remaining purpose is to manipulate. He literally describes rhetoric as a drug.
A drug?
A literal drug for the human soul. He says words can stop fear, they can remove grief, create joy, increase pity.
They alter your state of mind.
Yes. Yeah. But he also calls the art of persuasion an abduction by force.
Abduction by force? That is a violently vivid image.
It is meant to be.
Yeah.
Because think about it. If I persuade you by using logic and facts, I am engaging your rational mind as an equal.
Right. We are reasoning together.
But if objective truth is off the table, then all I am doing is drugging you with heavy emotions until you just do what I want.
I am basically hijacking your soul without your consent.
Exactly. It is the dark side of communication.
That honestly sounds like the textbook definition of propaganda.
It is the absolute birth of propaganda. And this naturally leads to the real-world political application of all this theory.
Mm-hmm.
Because if there is no truth and speech is just a weaponized drug to control people, then what does a word like justice even mean?
Enter Thrasymachus.
Enter Thrasymachus.
He is the guy who gets into that massive shouting match with Socrates in Plato's Republic. He is not interested in these abstract theories about color and communication. He's interested in who actually runs the city.
Right. Thrasymachus looks at how governments actually operate in the real world, not how they theoretically should work in a utopia.
Right.
And he drops a bomb on the conversation.
What does he say?
He says, justice is simply the interest of the stronger.
Mike.
It is deeply cynical, but he argues it is just historically factual. He says, look at any government anywhere.
Okay.
A democracy makes laws that specifically help the democratic mob. A tyranny makes laws that help the tyrant.
The ruling class always defines what is moral specifically to benefit themselves and to keep their grip on power.
Exactly. And Dr. Holmes points out how this directly prefigures the much later philosophy of Friedrich Nietzsche.
Oh, interesting. The will to power.
Yes. Nietzsche argued similarly that traditional morals are just constructs used to control people, and that the fundamental drive of human beings isn't towards justice, it's towards power. Thrasymachus is saying the exact same thing thousands of years earlier.
So when a politician gets up on a podium and talks passionately about justice or family values, Thrasymachus would say they're just using those pretty drugged words to protect their own bank accounts and status.
100%. Mm. Justice is a scam invented by the powerful to keep the weak in line. And the specific tool they use to enforce this scam is, you guessed it, rhetoric.
They use the drug of speech to convince the average citizen that the laws are for their own good,
when really, they are just for the benefit of the elite.
It is amazing how incredibly modern that feels. I mean, we hear that exact argument in political commentary every single day now.
It is the absolute baseline for real politic. And it sets up a really interesting practical problem for the ancient Greeks.
Which is?
Well, if Thrasymachus is right, and the laws of the land are just fake rules made up by powerful, selfish people, then what rule should a smart person actually follow?
This brings us to a guy named Antiphon.
Yes, Antiphon.
He feels like a bit of a twist in the story. He takes all this dark cynicism about the law and turns it into something else entirely.
He really does. Antiphon makes a very sharp distinction between nomos and physis.
Nomos meaning the laws of the state, and physis meaning the laws of nature.
Custom versus nature. Right. He totally agrees with Thrasymachus that state laws are entirely artificial. They're just based on temporary consent and public opinion.
But nature's laws,
those are compulsory. If you jump off a cliff, you fall. You cannot hold a vote against gravity.
So what is his actual advice then? How do we live in a society like that?
He proposes a survival strategy that is both clever and, frankly, kind of sketchy. He says, follow the artificial laws of the state whenever witnesses are present.
Just to avoid going to jail.
Right, to avoid the public shame and the physical punishment. But, and this is the key, when you are alone and there are absolutely no witnesses around,
follow the laws of nature.
Follow nature. Do what benefits you.
So basically, fake it in public, be real in private.
It sounds like a recipe for pure hypocrisy, but there is actually a much deeper, almost progressive insight hidden in here.
How so?
By completely stripping away the artificial laws and customs of society, Antiphon stumbles onto a truly radical idea for his time. If we look only at biology, only at nature, are human beings really that different from one another?
Right. This is the part that really surprised me. He uses this logic to challenge the very idea of nobility and even the strict division between Greeks and barbarians.
It is a huge moment in Western thought. Most Greeks firmly believed they were biologically and naturally superior to non-Greeks. It was baked into their worldview.
But Antiphon says no.
He says, look at the biology. We all breathe the air through our mouths and nostrils. We all laugh when we are happy. We all cry when we are in pain. We all have the exact same natural needs.
He uses this ruthless return to nature to argue for a fundamental human equality.
In a weird way, yes. Out of this extreme skepticism about society, we actually get the earliest seeds of universal human rights. If social status is totally fake, then biologically, we are all equal.
That is a wild trajectory. So let's take a breath and recap this sophist worldview before we move on.
Good idea.
So objective truth is impossible to find. Reality is whatever you can convince people it is. Speech is a powerful drug used to manipulate the mob. Justice is just a trick used by the powerful. And the smartest play is to look out for number one while pretending to follow the rules in public.
It is a highly compelling, deeply cynical, and frankly very successful worldview. It worked for a lot of people. But there was one man in Athens who could not stand it.
A man who was famously ugly, poor, and incredibly annoying to the elite.
Socrates.
The Socratic antidote.
He was the perfect foil to the sophists. While they were charging huge, exorbitant fees to teach you how to be rich and powerful and win every argument,
Socrates was just walking around the public marketplace for free, wearing the same old cloak, claiming he knew absolutely nothing.
He claimed total ignorance. But he had a very different, very specific metaphor for his life's work. The sophists probably call themselves teachers. They deposited knowledge into you.
But Socrates called himself a midwife.
An intellectual midwife. It is such a brilliant, enduring image.
His mother was actually a midwife, right?
She was. And he joked that he was just keeping the family business alive. But instead of helping women deliver babies, he was helping young men deliver ideas.
Brain children.
Brain children.
I love that concept. But the crucial thing about a midwife is that she doesn't give birth for you. She just helps the process along.
Exactly. Socrates claimed he had no actual wisdom of his own to give anybody. His only job was to help you give birth to your own beliefs. And then, and this is the most crucial part of his method, examine the baby to see if it was a healthy truth or a wind egg.
A wind egg. That is such a strange term. What is a wind egg?
It is an ancient term for a phantom pregnancy. Unfertilized egg. In this context, it means a false belief, a totally hollow idea.
Ah, okay.
He wanted to test your idea to see if it could actually survive logical scrutiny or if it was just hot air.
And the primary way he did this testing was through dialectic. Now, how is that practically different from the sophist's rhetoric?
It is night and day. Rhetoric is a monologue. Is a long, sweeping, beautiful speech designed to overwhelm your emotions and lull you into agreement.
It is the drug Gorgias talked about.
Exactly. Dialectic, on the other hand, is a dialogue. It is short, sharp questions and answers. It is an intellectual interrogation.
Give me a concrete example of how that clash would play out in real time.
Okay, picture this. Say a famous sophist gives a deeply moving hour-long speech about the glory of courage.
Everyone is clapping, people are crying, they're ready to march off to war.
Right. And then Socrates, from the back of the crowd, raises his hand and says, that was really beautiful. But just so I understand your terms, is courage simply defined as endurance of the soul?
And the sophist, wanting to sound wise, says, yes, of course it is.
Then Socrates asks, well, what about foolish endurance? If a man stubbornly refuses to retreat when he's clearly outmatched, and he ends up getting his entire unit killed. Is that courage?
And the sophist is trapped. He has to say, no, that is not courage. That is just stupidity.
Right. So Socrates says, okay, so courage isn't just endurance. It must be wise endurance.
Ah, I see.
And step by painful step through these simple little questions, he forces the other person to refine their definition, to spot their own glaring contradictions, and to actually think critically rather than just feel deeply.
He forces them to sober up. He wakes them up from the drug of rhetoric.
That's exactly it. He breaks the spell. And you have to understand, for Socrates, this wasn't just a fun logic puzzle or a parlor trick. It was literally a matter of life and death.
Because he believed that the care of the soul was the only thing that truly mattered in life.
The psyche, yes.
There is that famous quote from his trial, "The difficulty is not to avoid death, but to avoid unrighteousness."
He deeply believed that doing the wrong thing, living a lie, or using manipulation to get ahead, actually caused physical damage to your psyche. It made your soul sick.
So the sophists promised you the world. They promised you money, political power, ultimate success.
Well, Socrates promised you a healthy soul.
Mm-hmm.
But the steep cost of admission was realizing that you didn't actually know anything.
Which hurts the ego. Dr. Holmes brings up the historical example of Pericles to really illustrate this massive clash of values.
Yes, the great statesman.
Pericles was the ultimate successful Athenian. He built the empire, he built the monuments. But Plato and Socrates looked at him and thought he was a profound failure. Why?
Because Pericles was a master of the short game. He made Athens incredibly rich. He made it undeniably powerful. He used his soaring rhetoric to get exactly what he wanted from the assembly.
But he didn't care about their souls.
According to Plato, he completely failed as a true statesman because he didn't make the actual citizens into better people. He didn't implant temperance and true justice in their souls.
He just fed their base appetites. He gave them what they wanted, not what they needed.
Precisely. Socrates uses this great analogy. It is the difference between a doctor and a pastry chef.
The pastry chef gives you all the sugar that tastes amazing right now.
But it rots your teeth. The doctor gives you the bitter medicine that you hate, but actually heals you. The sophists were the pastry chefs of Athens.
And Socrates was the doctor.
Handing out the bitter medicine of dialectic.
Stepping back from ancient Athens for a second, this feels like the eternal, fundamental conflict of human communication. We are still fighting this exact same battle today.
We absolutely are. Look closely at our current information landscape. We are essentially drowning in the saucist approach to reality.
We literally have politicians talking about alternative facts.
We have digital algorithms that are specifically designed to feed us our truth, rather than the objective truth.
Right, because our truth keeps us clicking.
We have influencers, marketers, and politicians using incredibly sophisticated rhetoric to trigger our dopamine receptors, to literally drug us, rather than engage our critical reason.
When you frame it exactly like that, Protagoras saying man is the measure of all things sounds an awful lot like my social media feed is the measure of reality.
It really does. We are living in this intensely fragmented reality where the art of persuasion is valued so much higher than the actual truth.
Winning the debate, getting the likes, the ratio, the viral dunk is vastly more important to people than being factually or morally correct.
Which means the Socratic challenge is probably more relevant right now than it has ever been.
The challenge to just stop. To refuse to take the drug of easy answers and constant emotional outrage.
To take the bitter medicine and ask the hard foundational questions. To engage in dialectic with ourselves and with the people we disagree with.
And that brings us right back to Gorgias. I honestly cannot stop thinking about his dark idea of a speech as a literal drug. It is such a haunting, powerful concept.
It really changes how you view every single interaction you have. If words are essentially chemical agents that alter the human soul, we have a massive responsibility to be incredibly careful with them.
So here's the thought I really want to leave you with today as we wrap up this deep dive. As you go about your week, take a hard look at the messages you are constantly consuming and the words you are speaking to the people around you. Are you using your speech like a Socratic doctor to heal and clarify and desperately get to the truth? Or are you using it like a sophist to state, to manipulate, and just to win the moment?
And honestly, maybe even more importantly, are you willingly letting yourself be sedated by others?
Some very deep thoughts to chew on today. Thank you so much for taking this deep dive with us.
It is always a pleasure.